Good morning.
We only recognize Judith.
I must apologize. I'm not Judith, and I'm sorry to disappoint you. Judy, unfortunately, is not able to make it up this morning from Richmond because her daughter has a strep throat. So we wish her daughter a rapid recovery. In fact, Judy has a difficult decision to make today because she's supposed to fly to Moscow for a conference on health issues at the Higher School of Economics, and I think she is debating that. I am happy to be here and very, very pleased to welcome Irina Denisova. Dr. Denisova is a professor at the New Economics School in Moscow, and is also has been a core member of the Saphir research team, which is the research branch of the New Economics School. She teaches courses in macroeconomics and labor economics, and is also a researcher at the Central Institute of Economics and Mathematics, which, for anybody that knows anything about the Russian Academy, that is quite a prestigious place to study mathematics. Quite serious. She received her PhD degree from Manchester University in the UK after she'd finished a postgraduate program in economics at the Central Institute of Economics and Mathematics, CEMI, in Moscow. We're fortunate to have her down and kind of take advantage of a visit of hers to the States. She was just in New York to give a talk, I guess, was it over the weekend at the Association for the Study of Nationalities annual meeting. And today she'll be presenting some findings from her research, which is a part of a Ford Foundation supported grant, sort of,
partially.
On adult health and mortality in Russia through the lens of micro data. Irina, welcome to DC, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, and thank you for giving me an opportunity to present my paper here, and thank you for this very nice introduction with some details which I even start to forgetting.
I should have mentioned as well to the crowd. I mean, it's a kind of a small world because, of course, the New Economics School is a partner with CSIS and the Peterson Institute in the Russia Balance Sheet Project, and we just co-sponsored on Friday a big conference over at the Peterson Institute on the Russian economy and U.S.-Russia relations. So we're getting quite an excellent dose of your institution this week.
Yeah, so there is a lot of coincidences, which is very good. Yeah, I would like to speak today on the problem of adult mortality in Russia, which is very acute, and there are many papers on this. And so I will base my talk on the paper, mainly on the paper published in Economics of Transition last year. And so the title of the talk, what could we, in some sense, get new to know from the microdata which is available? Somehow I would feel better if I stand up. At the same time, there could be some... I can use it like that. Yeah, because being a teacher, it's somehow better for me. Yeah, so... You all know that Russia, together with some former Soviet countries, experiences what is called mortality crisis. And there is here you could see two graphs. So the graphs are life expectancy at birth in years. And to the left, this is a separate graph for males. To the right, the same graph for females. So on horizontal axis, you have years starting from 1970. 80, 90, and so with a gap of 10 years. And on the vertical axis, those are years of life, starting with 55, and the gap, the step is 5 years, so 55, 60, 65, 70. And so the, the scale is the same for males and females, so that also it's noticeable, the difference between genders. So here you see the trends and the, the indicator, the life expectancy and birth for four selected countries. The selected countries are the Russian Federation, which is in blue, Ukraine, which is in yellow, Lithuania, which is in green. Lithuania is one of the former Soviet states, but from the Baltic bloc, which started maybe maybe more rapidly on both reforms, and so maybe the tradition and health styles could be viewed as being rather different from the other countries of former Soviet Union. And for the matter of comparison, here is the Czech Republic as well, which is in red. So I would like you to notice several things from those graphs. First, you see that Russia has the lowest, even in the group of former Soviet Union states, life expectancy trend, both for males and females. And now, in the current year, life expectancy for males is something about 62 years. For females, it's about 73 years, which is pretty low on international schedule, and even for the group of former Soviet Union, it's far below. Not to say about, European countries such as Eastern European countries such as the Czech Republic. Another thing to notice is that, the life expectancy fluctuates a lot. And the major fluctuation, and this episode is in particular referred to as mortality crisis, happened at the beginning of the 90s. So starting from, say, 1990, there was a huge decline in life expectancy of about 6 years for males. Then there was a period of recovery for about 4 years. And then there was another decline, milder decline, for about 3 years, decline in life expectancy. Then, again, only recently, in 2008, it started to increase. So the first thing to notice, in some sense, is that there were some episodes of decline in life expectancy, meaning increase in mortality, in particular among males, and those periods coincided, at least in time, with the rapid economic reforms observed in the country. So the same kind of similar pattern, even though, well, less pronounced, is observed for females. But this is not the only fact to notice. Another fact to notice is that even for the period of observation, even starting from 1970, the group of those countries are not on any upward trend in life expectancy. And if you compare it to majority of patterns of developed countries, you would see that all of them are on a sort of upward life expectancy trend, more steep, less steep, but on an upward trend. So in some sense, it's not only the problem of, steep declines during certain periods, it's also the problem that for almost 60 years, or even before, the country is not on an upward trend of life expectancy, implying that, we do have some deep problem in respect to health in Russia. So the same kind of picture is characteristic for females, life expectancy with less pronounced declines and and also another thing in comparison to notice is that, it's well known that in every country there is a gender gap in life expectancy, but typically it's at the level of 4 to 5 years, and in Russia it's 12 years. So the difference is really huge. This situation attracts the attention of policymakers and researchers, and researchers in the developed world, they even say that, the Russian case, it's a special in the sense that the behavior of mortality rates and life expectancy, it's as if the country is in a war period, even though there are no large-scale war-type conflicts. And so the motivation for my paper is what do we know and what can we add looking at microdata on the factors which determine life expectancy and mortality rates in the population. So to what extent those factors are behavioral and to what extent they are not behavioral but environmental in some sense, in the broader sense. So, obviously, I am not the first to look at the data, and there are many, many studies which try to understand what are the major determinants of high mortality rates in Russia. And several possible explanations were suggested in the literature, especially looking at this period of upsurge in mortality and decline in life expectancy at the very beginning of transition period. And, well, there were several, and there are several candidates. The first possible candidate is fall in income and rise in poverty during the initial years of transition, which could imply malnutrition or unhealthy diet for some groups of population. And that could, in fact, resulted in an upsurge of mortality rates at the very beginning of the 90s. And even though we are lacking the data from the very beginning of the 90s, and the data set which I will base my talk on starts only from 1994, but still there were attempts to try to look at this, and there were no statistically significant results with this respect. So in some sense, it's not supported. Well, the major determinant and the major candidate is excessive alcohol consumption, and the pattern of alcohol consumption where, well, people drink hard liquids. And there are many papers on this, and those papers, they do support the huge role of this factor. And those majority of papers are based on what could be called aggregate level data. So they are based, and there I switch for a moment to this slide. So majority of the studies, they base the study of the phenomenon of mortality and life expectancy based on death certificate data, because this is what is available. So based on death certificate data, and it's not available, well, these data are not available as microdata. They are aggregated across regions, across causes of death, and then are available to researchers. And the limitation of studies of mortality based on this data is that there is only little information available to try to understand what are the determinants of mortality rates. So death certificate has information on gender, on age, and on cause of death. And it's basically on the interpretation on the cause of death structure that people attribute, say, to alcohol consumption or to smoking or to possibly some other factors that they play a large or little role. And obviously, there are good things about using this death certificate data for the analysis, because this data gives you information about the general population, total population. It's not sample, it's just total available information from the total population. A bad thing is that you are limited in disentangling effects of different factors. Yeah, but being back to the possible, yeah, so the majority of the studies on the effect of alcohol consumption and binge drinking, they are based on this death certificates paper data, and so based on the clinical studies, probability that the death from, say, cardiovascular disease is caused by excessive alcohol consumption, so this data is analyzed, and as a result, so an increase in this type of cause of death is related to increase in alcohol consumption, and increase in alcohol consumption is also supported by the data from sales. Another group of variables or possible determinants is related to different measures of stress. Obviously, well, stress is always in our life, but in the period of rapid economic changes, when large groups of population changed their, had to change their lives, it could be expected that the level of stress, the average level of stress increased, and in addition, there were different groups who encountered lower or higher stress as well. The problem with this determinant and with this factor is the problem of measuring the stress. And so there are some attempts of measuring this stress through again using sometimes as in Brainerd and Kettler, using the same type of data I used. But otherwise, given the difficulty in capturing the stress itself, so there is not huge evidence in support of this factor. So it's still, everybody thinks it should matter, but it's difficult to measure. That's why it's a problem in some sense to measure it statistically. Another factor, given the general disorganization during the initial 90s, so it could be thought that the health sector also was disorganized in some sense. And so that could also affect the increase in mortality rates at the beginning of the 90s. Again, the problem to statistically support this hypothesis is that you really need measures. In statistical sense to try to test this. The same applies to possibly deterioration of social capital, because the social capital, as it was in the Soviet times, was ruined in some sense and deteriorated, and the new social capital was only under formation, and it also could affect the ability of people to adjust to the new life. Whenever better social network you have, the more support you get to be able to adjust to the shocks you encounter. Another issue which I focus particularly in my paper and in some sense position my paper as in terms of at least academic research as evaluating in this sense is the question about the role of income inequality and relative deprivation in affecting health and mortality rates. So this question actually has some story at some point, a lot of multinational cross-country studies, they showed that the countries with high inequality, they have lower life expectancy and high mortality rates. But then it seemed to be a well-established fact. And the mechanism which is behind this correlation is that if, you position yourself relatively low and rank yourself relatively low in society, you are exposed to could be called permanent stress. And that affects your health and increases mortality rates. This data was type of strand of research was later criticized on the basis of in comparison of the data across countries, because at that period at least the results were based on using data from different countries, and the data was collected based on somewhat different procedures and methods, and also it was criticized on the basis of methodology used. And the later studies, which used comparable across countries data and, better in some sense, improved methodology, so they didn't confirm this result about correlation of inequality and higher mortality rates. And there is a discussion in the literature, and Deaton is one of the well-known scholars who write on this, and the suggestion from Deaton as an expert is that there should be, it doesn't mean that inequality does not matter. It could be that we measure inequality in a very poor way. And he suggests that it's not only income dimension inequality in society. So if you control for, based on micro studies, if you control for what could be called objective measures of income, so if you control for the income position of household in terms of the per capita income they get, then those measures of subjective income position of household or an adult it's found to be not statistically significant. And the implication and the suggestion from Deaton is that it's not only income-related and monetary-based relative self-ranking which matters. It's also something non-necessarily income-based. And in majority of cases, majority of data sets, they are lacking this non-monetary measures. And the good thing about the data I use is that it has this, and so I test for this hypothesis in particular. Now I will tell in details on, about my study. Before this, I simply just mentioned this sort of, I don't know, provocative for the study of Stackler and his co-authors, which generated a whole of, succeeding papers which appeared later. You may have heard about this. It was a study, cross-country study, based on the sample of transition countries, and they studied correlation between mortality rates and the different measures of reforms in those countries. And they found out that the speed of privatization is related to mortality rate. And so in the countries with high privatization, with high speed of privatization reforms, as a result, we observed high mortality rates. So this study actually got special attention from the media as well. And especially here, you must have remembered, here in the States, you must have remembered Economist magazine coming out with a portrait of David Sachs, Mao Zedong, and Stalin saying they killed millions. And in my profession, it caused a scandal as well, because the problem with this paper was that actually it was published in a very respected medical journal, but according to the standards of my profession, the methodology was not correct. And as a response, several papers appeared using the same data, showing that if you at least control for the initial position, this effect disappears. And But anyway, so there is some this paper, and at least it attracted additional efforts to look in the in this direction. Yeah. So what I try to do here, as I mentioned, I try to identify role of different factors in determinants of mortality rates. So the data which I use, which allows me to be more specific and more detailed in disentangling those effects, is the Russian longitudinal monitoring survey data, which is longitudinal in its structure, and it started in 1994, and it continues till now. It's only that I used it till the period of 2007 for my research, but it's available, and it appeared initially with the support of the World Bank, and then USAID also supported it for a while, and different organizations participated in this. It was launched initially by the University of North Carolina Population Center, and we in Russia were very lucky first to have this survey of households, because say, in comparison, many other former Soviet Union states, they didn't have it, at least from that period. Later on, some studies appeared. And the second fact was that we are happy that from the very beginning, this micro data set became publicly available, which also boosted research in this area. So this is a nationally representative data set, and about 4,000 households are surveyed each year. And there is a household questionnaire, and also there is adult questionnaire and a child questionnaire. And on average, it's about 10,000 adults who are surveyed each round. And the data is available almost each year in the period, except 2 years when there were no funds to have this survey, and it is not available for 1998 and for 1996. Yeah, but otherwise it's available. Yeah, what is good about, first I need to say that thanks to the participation of the University of North Carolina Population Center, the standards of both sampling and training of interviews and questionnaire design is up to the world level. So that means that the data is respected and trusted, which is very important when you work with data. In terms of my task and trying to identify factors behind mortality, it's very important that it has longitudinal data. It's not true panel in the sense that every household is traced whenever the household moves out of the dwelling. It's not like that. It's dwelling-based. So whenever household keeps living in the same dwelling, it's surveyed each round. Well, unless it refuses and says, no, I don't want to participate further, but somehow, organizers, they persuade household to participate on and on. But when a household moves out, then if it moved out and it's in the same city, then they are found and surveyed. If they moved out somewhere, to a different city, they are not found. They are not looked for, they are not found, and that means that in this dwelling, another new household appears in the data. In the result, we have the structure of the data when we have households, the same households, being in the survey for several periods. It varies, so some households appear for 2 years, some households appear for 6 years or for 10 years. But what is good is that we at least observe the same households for several years. So how can one study mortality based on household level data? It's based on the information that if the household was already previously in the sample and interviewers come to this so-called old household next year, they ask whether all the members of household who were surveyed last year are available. And if not, so there is a question why those household members are not there. And it could be that household member moved out to another address, possibly working abroad or working in another region, or some part of household separated, and it's also another household. But it's possible that the person died between the between the observations. And the survey is typically done in October, November, December. So it's once a year and in late autumn. Yeah, and starting from 2001, even information of basic groups of causes of death are registered, well, based on the ones reported by other household members. And as a result, we observe during this period starting from 1994 to 2007, we observe people whom we surveyed, organizers of survey surveyed in previous year, and as a result, we know a lot about this person, about his labor market position, about what he thinks, about his lifestyle, also about his subjective self-ranking, and we know that this person died in between of the rounds. That allows, that allows to control and to try to test a richer set of hypotheses about determinants of mortality rates. What is not good about this is that given that the sample is 4,000 households, death is not a very often event in this sample, but on average it's about 100 people who die between rounds, which is not large, but which is not small as well. So if we recalculate the death rates, what could be called average crude death rate, based on the data I use and compare it to the population data published by Rostat, so we see that we have in RLMS about 10 to 12 per 1,000 death rate, and in the general population we have 15 to 16. So the death rate is underestimated on this sample, it's about two-thirds that we see. It's a question why do we have less death rate here? Yeah, it could be that maybe, first thing is that mass surveys, they typically do not, are not able to reach the very bottom of income distribution. Yeah, it's normal for everybody, and possibly the death rates in this tail is higher. That's one thing. Maybe some other groups are not there. It's still an open question, but so we gain something, but we lose something as well, so we're switching across data sets. At the same time, if you analyze the structure of the deaths by gender, say, you see that at least it's comparable, the proportion is comparable across the general population and RLMS sample. Say for males, it's much higher, it's 6 to 10 per 1,000 as compared to 10 to 12 in the total population. And for females, it's much lower, it's from 1.5 to 2.5 compared to 2.5 to 3.5 per 1,000 in the population. So those ranges are given here because I have more than 10 years, and so it varies across years as well. And also in terms of, here is some table about the frequency of those death cases. And so I leave this, I will provide references to the paper so you could find it there. Looking at the age structure, of those who are registered to be to pass away in the survey sample. So here we see to the left is the graph for males, to the right is the graph for females, and this is simple. Those are simple frequency graphs across age groups. And here you can see that for males, we see that much more males in working age pass away as compared for females, right? So females, on average, live and pass away later in time, which is also a good sign for the quality of the data set, because it really as it is registered in the general population. Yeah. So both in gender structure and in age structure, the sample, the data from the sample from the survey, sounds to be reasonable to study mortality on. And it's well known that this graph, this trend in adult mortality rate for males is basically determined by the pattern of mortality among males of working ages. So the major problem is what determines mortality rates of males in working ages. Speaking about methodology, I would be brief here. It's traditional methodology to study such things, and basically, formally it's called survival type of analysis, and what you estimate from the data, you estimate the conditional probability to live conditional probability to die, say, at the age of 50, conditionally that you survived till the year 49. And for those, given this methodology, it, in comparison to other possible approaches, it gives you an opportunity not to lose and to use in the estimation procedure those who could be called observations with uncompleted spell. Spell is in this setting is the lifespan. So we have some people who died during the sample, but we have a lot who haven't died yet. And so technically speaking, in this estimation, those who died, for them, this conditional probability to die at age 50, conditional that you live, survive till years 49, is estimated. But for those who haven't died yet, it's just, it's a methodological term. This survival rate is estimated, and it's also the probability that you lived till the year 50 and haven't died yet. So it's in technical terms. So in the estimation, it's not only that about 1,300 observations are used, it's the whole. It's the total number of different observations throughout the period which are used. So it's based not on this small amount of people who died, but rather on a larger sample of those who haven't died and who died already. And how to how it basically what this methodology does? It estimates some average hazard rate. This is conditional probability to die at certain age. And for the whole population. And then it identifies the role of different factors in shifting this conditional probability to die up or below. So, and this assumption about this proportional hazard model is particularly about this assumption that, well, for instance, smoking, if you smoke, then this average probability to die would, we would expect, would go up. If you pursued healthy lifestyle, then this average probability pattern would move down. So that's it about methodology. Now about factors and candidates for determinants. Well, the most important, well, at least what I wanted to try to identify in this data set, that is some different measures of stress. First, I also used the measure which already was used. One measure of stress is uncertainty about affordable consumption. There is a question in the survey which asks, how concerned are you about the possibility that you might not be able to provide yourself with the bare essentials in the next 12 months? And so it's used as binary variable in my paper. But the a value added in some sense is that I use those battery of questions with respect to self-reported and self-perceived rankings. There are three questions of this type. One question is on income schedule, on income scale. And the question is as follows. Please imagine a nine-step ladder where on the bottom, the first step, stand the poorest people, and on the highest step, the ninth, stand the rich. On which step of the nine are you today? This is income-based level ladder. There are two non-income ladders. One is with respect to powerful people versus absolutely not impowerful people. And another is respected people versus absolutely not respected in the society people. So I will read the question about respected. another nine-step ladder where on the lowest step stand people who are absolutely not respected, and on the highest step stand those who are very respected. On which of the nine steps are you personally standing today? So it's very standard question in some sense of self-ranking, and we are lucky that the survey consistently keeps asking this question every round. And so these are the questions in terms of academic value added, I consider the most important one. Also, other factors which I control for and try to identify their influence in my paper. First, maybe let's start with traditional factors about health detrimental behavior. There is information about alcohol consumption and about smoking in this data set. And respondents asked whether they smoke or not. And in terms of smoking, actually, even more detailed questions are asked about when have you started, have you quit it ever, how many cigarettes you smoke. Here in this paper, I use only the indicative type of variable, which is whether you smoke or not. And irrespective of number of cigarettes you smoke, at the same time, it's in line with the thirds of medical profession people who say that if you smoke, well, it's in some sense matters not very much how much do you smoke, because it's poisoning at each cigarette. And another thing is about alcohol consumption. Here, the variable I use, people asked whether they how often they drink alcohol beverages and different types of beverages. And here I call binge drinkers or frequent consumers those who drink 4-6 times per week or every day. And say if we were in France, we would see a lot of population drinking wine during lunch, right? But the pattern that I've checked it, and you also could do this, says the pattern of drinking in Russia is those who drink frequently, they drink hard liquids together with something else, but basically vodka and something else. And in the data sample, in terms of smoking, it's about 35 in my sample. It's about 35% who smoke, and in terms of very frequent drinkers, it's about 3% of those who follow this pattern. Also, I tried to understand the influence of labor market factors, and at least I controlled for, well, it's not here, but I do control for whether the person was unemployed or not. I even tried, given that I have, well, for many people, I have information about their situation in the labor market for several years. I even tried variables of controls for how long you were out, so for one period or for longer periods, but it turns out not to be very significant. Also, it was possible to identify different labor market trajectories looking at this data. And, well, the type of variables I used is whether the person moved a lot, well, across different types of employment, or the person did not, right? What could be the rationale behind using this kind of distinction between trajectories? Well, and by the way, it turns out to be, it shows to be significant in the results, but rationally is it's not per se movement across different types of jobs. It reflects something about, I don't know, possibly psychological mobility of the person, because there are different situations, and we know in Russia some people who are trained as, say, engineers, and even though their sector and their enterprise is doing very poorly, so they didn't quit and they kept, I don't know, be stuck with their position and sector of work. At the same time, we know a lot of engineers trained, those trained as engineers, who work wherever in economy. And so in some sense, it could reflect, could be a measure of, I don't know, more mobile, more flexible type of personality. At least this is how I would like to interpret this. Yeah, another thing is, obviously, I do control for economic well-being of the household, and I control for the consumption level in terms of per capita consumption in household, and the information about income and consumption is very good in this survey, and they are very careful about collecting information about expenditure and income, and also I tried measures of poverty incidence and duration, and poverty as defined in absolute terms. Also, there is an issue about alcohol prices. And there was a paper by Dan Trisman in the literature list I had, and he has a paper actually published in the same volume as my paper, based on regional data on Russia, panel data on consumption of alcohol in Russian regions and mortality rates. And his analysis shows that those regions... consumption and alcohol prices. Consumption, alcohol prices, and mortality rates. And his data confirms, and his analysis confirms, that the regions where prices of alcohol were relatively low, they experienced higher mortality rates. And he interprets this as sort of compromise or trade-off or even, a result of regional authorities who tried to obtain social peace in some sense at the expense of lower prices on hard liquids, on vodka, and as a result, they got higher mortality rates. So based on regional data, he has this result. I do have information about alcohol prices because in addition to, I should praise this survey once more. In addition to the adult questionnaire, household questionnaire, child questionnaire, there is communal questionnaire which registers in the locality major prices. And I use variables relative price of vodka in the locality relative to bread. And there is some variation across localities here, and so I try to check Trisman hypothesis, but based on the microdata. And I also control for basically for gender education and education variables, and also for self-reported health and some health measures. Yeah, so results. Now, results. First, how to interpret those figures here. Those two columns, which will be continued on the next slides, are different measures. you could be could interpret this as robustness checks. So if it's a bit different methodology of estimating what is called baseline hazard, but otherwise they are comparable. And one should need to compare the figure here with one. So if the figure here is below one, that means that this factor helps to lower mortality rate. So the dependent variable is hazard to mortality, that is mortality rate, yeah, conditional mortality rate. So if this figure is below one, that means that this factor helps to lower mortality. The higher the factor, the lower is mortality rate. If, for instance, here, this coefficient is higher than one, that means that as a result of increase in this, determinant, you have higher mortality rate. And obviously, as always, those stars are about statistical significance. So the first block is about economic well-being. As expected, the richer the household, the lower are mortality rates. So poor households indeed have higher mortality rates. Richer households have lower mortality rate. This is, in line with all the available papers on mortality. I also tried, whether the experiencing an episode of poverty affects your chances to survive further in life or not. And it turns out that it's, at least marginally statistically significant is the first episode of poverty of your household. And it increases the probability to get, one of the members of your household passed away. But it's only the first episode. And it's also in line with some studies which show that it's only the first episode which matters, and then somehow people adjust. And so all the later episodes are not that relevant. So the major group of factors which I keep stressing on is this self-perceived specific status. So remember that we controlled for this what is called objective measure of income. So it's here we do control for this effect. On top of this, if we include this economic rank, self-positioning in terms of monetary measure, here you see that it's not statistically significant. So, when we have this objective measure, this subjective measure doesn't matter. At the same time, if we include this non-income or non-monetary measure of self-ranking, it shows to be statistically significant. So those who position themselves closer to those who are very respected in the society, they have lower probability of dying. And we will interpret the size of this coefficient a bit later. Another stress indicator turned out to be not statistically significant. So other group of variables is about habits. So those who smoke, we see have very high coefficient, the very high chances of die as compared to those who don't smoke. So those who drink frequently and drink hot liquids also have very high probability, much higher probability to die. And even though this effect of alcohol is widely documented in the literature, I would say that the effect of smoking, at least in the Russian context, is at least was underlooked in some sense. There was some papers which pointed to this effect, but the thing is that those effects are of comparative size. Puts your attention to the role of smoking, and I will say some words during concluding remarks about the current discussion with respect to smoking and policies with respect to smoking. So in terms of relative price of vodka, this is in some sense trying to test the treatment hypothesis. Well, I don't find it statistically significant, at least on microdata. I do not confirm his result. The labor market situation, it affects, and you can see that if you are unemployed, you have higher chances of higher risk of dying. If you are of a more flexible personality, measured as, I don't know, that you moved in the labor market to different directions, it turns out to be life-saving behavior in some sense. And the question about healthcare accessibility, which is not very rich but available in the data set, it turns out to be statistically not significant. And to complete this regression, so it's the same regression, just different variables. Speaking about family size, the influence of family size could be twofold. In some sense, the higher family you have, maybe more potential of supporting mechanism you have. But at the same time, the larger family you have, more support potential you could get from family members. At the same time, the larger family you have, the more you are concerned about getting, I don't know, income and going on with life. So it could be both. And here we see that the second mechanism, that the larger family you have, the higher chance of getting, passing away you have. But this is, we need to mention, controlling for the presence of children in the household. So if there are children in the household, then it's life-saving in the sense that you have those who have children in their households, they on average live longer than those who don't. So in this type of analysis, what is good is that we can distinguish across different sub-factors even, right? So it's not the size of the family per se. If you distinguish this family size from having children within household, then otherwise the larger family could bring you some additional stress in this situation when you need to provide means of support to your household members. And speaking about education groups, as expected, those who have university degree or higher, they have less risk of dying as compared to those reference group here, which is those who graduated from secondary school only or even haven't graduated from secondary school. And so those with higher educational degree, they tend to live longer, both because they are more aware about the effects of how to maybe about the production function of health, let's say, something like that. Yeah, and controlling for whether the household lives in urban settlement or in rural settlement, on average at least, so if the household lives in urban settlement, those members have a higher probability of living longer or lower probability of dying before. At the same time, interestingly, if you run separate regressions for males and females, then it's actually for males, the effects from the male regression which drives this results. So, it's males in the cities who, as compared with males who live in rural areas, who tend to live longer, conditional on other factors. And for females, it's not statistically significant, but with time, the direction of movement into the higher probability of dying in urban areas as compared to villages and rural areas. There are not many things which you could do here, but at least something. Yeah, and here are the graphs to interpret the coefficients. We got off the maybe the most interesting things. So here, on each graph, it's the predicted survival function or survival probabilities for two groups each time. So here, for instance, this is survival functions for smokers and non-smokers, implying that those are life years. So those who smoke, and this is this dashed line, so on average, they live less at each age. And on average, if you calculate this distance in terms of life years for the major age groups, that would, for smoking, would amount for about 8 years. So on average, smoking causes about 8 years of life, And this is controlling for whether you are your household, on the income position of your household, on some other stress factors. This is control on many, many things, including control on alcohol consumption. And so the same type of exercise, so those who drink heavily, and this is dashed line again, so they tend to live less in, lower survival function, which is technically called at each age, and on average that could be implied as 10 years of life. So 8 to 10 years of life, this is binge drinking. Now about interpretation of the coefficient of this respect rank self-positioning. You remember that the size of coefficient was not that large, but we remember that we have 9 steps there. And the interpretation is that this is coefficient for movement from one step to the next one. And so here on this graph, you see the survival functions, the probability to live till certain year for those who position themselves very lowly at their lowest respect rank. So they are here, the lowest survival function. Then those who position themselves somewhere in the middle, so this grade is equal 5. And the last one at the highest respective. They position themselves among those people who are the most highly respected in the society. And the average distance in the average life years when we move from the lowest to the middle one is 4 years. So it's not little. This effect is not little. And so if that would be movement from the lowest to the highest, it could be comparable to the effect of smoking. So it's always advisable to at least try to think about the size of the effects. So this relative self-positioning in society in terms of non-monetary scale is really important. And this is a measure of chronic stress people have. And especially in the situation of countries which experience significant changes and movements of people from one social position to another social position. And we have reallocation of massive groups of people across social stratas. One could expect that this is one of the factors which really affects people's health. Yeah, and so now summarizing results, at least one of the most important results, as I consider it, is this relative status result, that even controlling for income position of household, self-ranking across non-income direction turns out to be significant and sizable. Also, the role of smoking should not be forgot about. Well, I don't understand that here in this country, at least for already more than a decade, I believe, you have rather intensive policy of anti-smoking policy. Maybe you may have forgot about that in other countries people tend to smoke a lot, and in Russia people tend to smoke really a lot. And it's about 60% of males who smoke and about 35% of females who smoke. And the recent survey about tobacco consumption of the Russian individuals, it showed up that in the age group of teenagers, the smoking of girls it's almost about 30%, and it's not the girls who tried this, the girls who permanently smoke, almost daily smokers, and it's at the level of boys. So the situation changed to the worst during those transition years in terms of smoking in Russia because of the aggressive policy of tobacco producers and the inability or maybe something else from the side of authorities to protect this. And the changes is that the younger generation of females started smoking more. So people tend to start smoking more. And the prices of cigarettes are very low in Russia. And it's only recently that policy debates about changes in the situation started in a more intensive way, even though Russia signed this general framework in agreement to fight this smoking prevalence. Still, some measures are to be done only, and it's debatable whether we have in which public spaces we prohibit smoking, and also in terms of excise taxes. There is some schedule of increasing excise taxes, but very even not in line with inflation. And only recently, at least, we got some interest, including from the Minister of Finance, to think about more radical increase in excise taxes. And one of the problems with this is really very strong tobacco-related lobby, which, I don't know, doesn't allow. Speaking about potential increase of contraband in tobacco products after increase in excise taxes and possibly in prices, and so they keep speaking about this. But recently, at least this the alternative group also did some additional work, and we also participated in this. And recently, we published a survey about the attitude of Russian population to the measures of increasing anti-tobacco legislation, including some attitude to the increase in prices. And we hope that it will help. It will affect political decisions as well. At least some talks started about possibly increasing excise taxes. But because even before, some people, even from in the Ministry of Finance, they were against increasing excise taxes. At the same, we do understand that high oil and gas prices provide additional money inflow, but at the same time, come on. It's obvious that it's health detrimental, and you will gain money in the budget, so why not? But they were keeping speaking about this contraband thing and all the stuff. And even the example of Ukraine didn't help too much, because Ukraine recently increased excise taxes twice and kept increasing this more. And as a result, they saw some diminishment in smoking prevalence and significant increase in collection of excise taxes, not too much contraband as well. But Ukraine was lucky in the sense that they didn't have this flow of oil and gas money, and they applied for IMF loan, and IMF told them, come on, guys, you have so low excise taxes on tobacco, increase it first, and then you will get it, and they did. And in some sense, they were lucky on this. Yeah, I hope that something will change on this as well. There is no support on tourism resulted my data, but it's a usual situation that in data with different level of aggregation, you have different results. Speaking about policy implications, this is the last slide. in some sense, this paper confirms adverse effect of rapid economic changes when you don't have mechanisms to support people in stressful situations. Because here we do control for many things other than stress, and it turns out that these stress measures are really significant. That is not to blame economic changes, because some of them are, there are always stresses in our lives, and even if in the countries when you don't have very rapid restructuring of economy, you do have some shocks periodically. And the role for intervention in society is to try to think to create more about formal or informal mechanisms to support people to survive through those stressful periods. And there is a literature in psychology which says that at least with respect to different types of shocks, if you are speaking about family-related issues, some divorces, I don't know, then it's family network or friends network which could be of really help to you. In terms of your labor-related transitions, it doesn't work. So this family or friend-related network doesn't help you. You need to assist publicly or communally or whatever. So it's in addition on top of the help and support you could get from your closer circle, you need to have some additional measures. And also, there is huge role for civil society in not only information of social support mechanisms, but also in healthy lifestyle propaganda, because, those who don't watch TV in Russia would be surprised how, intendedly or unintendedly, those people from whom a younger generation is taking them as an example of the lifestyle. So they keep being very, free about their smoking and drinking. And I always keep putting an example of, there is one TV show in Russia, which is called Projector Paris Hilton, which is related to Projector Perestroika before, but Paris Hilton is, who she is. And so that there are there are four guys who are in this, very smart young guys, very successful people. And once they invited, Mickey Rourke was in Russia, and then invited Mickey Rourke to speak to them. And Mickey Rourke is known for unhealthy lifestyle, I would say. And they were speaking, and then Mickey Rourke said, I would like to smoke, so why not? And he smoked. And not only he smoked, but all of them started smoking. Before I didn't know whether they smoke or not. Now, whatever they say, I know they do smoke. Then he said, Russian vodka is so good. Why shouldn't we drink? They brought in vodka, he drank, and all of them drank. I think that it's a question for... This is the major national TV channel. And this is about... the only hope I have is that those smart guys unintentionally do this. So it's not that they persuade some partners and try to put this propaganda in this direction of some, tobacco companies and alcohol producers' policy, but this is shocking in some sense. So these examples, we need to think about this. Thank you so much.
Very interesting study. Arina, let me just ask one question of clarification before we go to the rest of the group. We have about 15 minutes or so. I was struck, and maybe I didn't get this right, but the RLMS database versus Rostat seemed to be quite a serious difference. I thought in the Rostat estimations of mortality were considerably higher than RLMS. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's different in the sense that Rostat, it generates based on death certificates. It's the general population in these statistical terms. So they collect information about all the population on a regular basis. So it's administrative data. And with exception of some, unregistered cases, which are relatively small in size, so they collect, this is general population. In terms of mortality as based on RLMS, yes, it's significantly lower. And the question is why? So there could be the major explanation is that this is survey versus general population in statistical terms, implying that this sample in terms of health and mortality risks looks different than the representative in terms of mortality and health risks, general population is. And it's still an open question why, and it could be that there's some lower income tail groups are underrepresented here, as in every mass survey you can't reach them. You can't reach the richest, and drinking is also widespread among rich in Russia, but I would doubt that they have higher death rates as the average population of the RLMS. So it's mainly maybe about this lower tail of income distribution. That's one possible, which could add. But there could be some other reasons, and I spoke to demographers. They also don't know why it happens. The good thing is that at least in terms of structure of the deaths registered here and in general population, both gender structure and age structure look very similar. meaning that, well, not precisely by the age groups, because I didn't compare this and there's little need to do this, but in terms of working versus non-working age population, and in terms of genders, the proportions look very similar. So there are good things about using survey versus aggregate data, because you could control and disentangle among many more interesting determinants. But you really should understand that the sample is biased in some sense with respect to the general population. Yeah.
As a survey is having some behavior modification effect by itself? Is it because the question is asked? It's not just one-time survey. It's longitudinal survey. Sometimes even just somebody cares and come and ask could modify behavior or, you know, psychological status. It was noticed before, so it may not be so much loss to follow up as just effect of being in a survey per se. So it's kind of like survival selection bias.
It could be the problem is that obviously it couldn't explain one third of missing. You are right, absolutely. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah. Thank you so much for the questions. First to unemployment. I do control for the health status and disability status in regression. So on this size, it's as if I control for the type of unemployed people. But if you look through the group of unemployed as reported in RLMS, self-reported, because they asked traditional questions, and I identified as ILO or Bureau of Labor Statistics type of unemployed, so there are almost no people with disability there, because they are out of labor force in this sense. With respect to war children, it's an interesting question. That's true, and obviously, I don't know. there should be demographers looking at this, because this is really one of the demographic type of things. And I also thought once about this with respect to at least people who were born during war. Also, there is, I don't know, it's maybe really complicated issue in the sense that maybe only the strongest survived at least. As well, right? So it's more complicated issue, and this is for demographers to look at that. I haven't traced whether there is paper like that on this. I hope there is, but I haven't met it yet. But remind me about this, because once I was interested in this as well, and then I will try to find this out. Thank you. Thank you so much for the interesting, very interesting questions. Yeah, first on education level. Well, at least given that it's known from other studies and other countries as well that the higher the education you have, the higher, well, probability to survive you have and the better your health is. So at least we are lucky that at least in terms of educational effect, we do have a relatively large group of population with a university degree. But it helps to counteract other factors. But other factors such as alcohol consumption and smoking are really very high. And among rich groups of population and among those highly educated people, there are many smokers and a significant number of those who drink a lot. So it counteracts, but it can't counteract completely. With respect to self-ranking, you are absolutely right that, well, first, it's reflection of something, some problems. So why do people position themselves differently? It's a separate issue and a separate study, and there are some attempts to study what determines the self-ranking on whatever scale, including the respect scale. And you are right that it varies not only across countries and cultures, but in terms of it varies across individuals as well. And so in some sense, the formulation of the question here is allows to escape this very complicated issue of what is the reference group for those people, because it's good in some sense that you should not care about this, but at the same time, obviously, for each of those people who all of those respondents, they have in mind their own reference group, and it could. Well, even though you say very respected versus completely unrespected people in society, but everybody have their own variation of reference group, right? And this is always true for subjective type of questions. Yeah, so to sum up, yes, you are right that this is an interesting direction of research to try to understand what determines this. There are some papers on this, basically on the relation to income, position of household, and there is some relation to this, but this is not the only one. And that would be a separate research. Thanks.
Another question of clarification, Irina, on the you noted that the impact of smoking over time was about the right neighborhood of 8 years, reducing life expectancy. Drinking, 8 to 10. The respect issue, are these compound? If you're a heavy drinker, if you're a binge drinker and a heavy smoker, does that mean your life expectancy is going to be reduced 18 years?
Yeah, I see.
How does it work?
Well, in principle, this methodology interprets the coefficients that having other things equal, meaning for this is the effect of this particular factor. So in some sense, they should be summed up. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, so obviously this is average effect, and there are only, I don't know, among those group of three people who are binge drinkers in this survey, how many of them position themselves at a very low respect rank? Well, it's necessary to try to identify what is the group for whom you could sum up this effect. Yeah, you're right. But in principle, the interpretation of this type of analysis that having fixed all the rest, so this is the effect of this particular factor, meaning that in principle you should just sum up this. You could see, there was a graph on the age of dying of certain people, and you see that some of them died pretty early in life. And you never know, what was the potential life expectancy based on biological issues. There. Okay. Thank you so much for the question. I will start with the first part. Those people who work and analyze tobacco market, they say that 95% of sales are controlled by three multinational companies. So it's not local production. Well, it could be produced locally, but it's one of the three huge multinational companies, tobacco companies. At the same time, the wholesales they see are controlled, are channeled by one company in Russia, private. One company. So in this sense, experts say that, well, how come you could speak about contraband, massive contraband of tobacco in case of increase of excise taxes, given that the market is almost monopolized, and you know those guys who, well, organize these wholesales and distribute in retail sale. It's well known, and massive contraband could come only through those major producers. It's not that the local small producers could organize massive contraband. It would be produced on the same factories, but simply not paying excise taxes. So this is how the market for tobacco looks. On advertisement, actually. Given that, unfortunately, not only legislation, but also enforcement of legislation in Russia is very poor, advertisement thing is very aggressive by those tobacco companies. And it's not only that, well, in principle, you should not be sold cigarettes if you're under 18. But it's violated here and there, and there is little liability, well, weak enforcement of this, and there are talks about increasing the penalty for selling cigarettes to younger people. On top of this, speaking about the how the packs look, there are examples of some packs which I couldn't identify as cigarette packs, because this is some Barbie type something which targets even not those, 14-year-old who are not interested in this stuff anymore. This is more for, 10-year-old girls, say. And they are still in the market. And even though, Russia signed this general framework, and within the period of 3 years it should reduce and introduce all those measures, still they are available. Also, there are those tricks by both alcohol companies, but also by tobacco companies, who manage to get into schools, and even for first year class children, they somehow, tricks about informing that they should not smoke, that they provide information that it's available, and also these campaigns that make a choice not to smoke. Or it's your choice to smoke or not. Given that children would like to position themselves as adults, obviously this is propaganda as well, and it's absolutely aggressive and very cynical in Russia. And the companies, the perception is that the tobacco companies got very restricted in developed countries, and they moved in less developed countries, and they are very aggressive, and they managed to increase the prevalence of smoking among Russian children. And they really target this group because their market depends on this, because this is an addiction good, right? So you tend to be addicted to this. And this is a really problem, and it's really a shame that neither the civil society nor the government is rather active in this direction. Sometimes you could think that, this is again about the question of two separate societies, in the sense that there are some people in power who think that, it's not about us and our children, it's about them. And sometimes you are really frustrated about this, unfortunately. So everything is related. And
one last.
No, it's still 55 for females and 60 for males. It's under discussion, the increase on, and or at least the well equalizing of this pension age, but well, it didn't happen.
Irina, thank you so much. The results of this study have appeared where?
So they are published in Economics of Transition 2010. Yeah, so it's
okay.
This EBRD type of thing. Yeah, okay.
Thank you very much. It was really tremendous. I learned a lot, and I really appreciate you spending time with us today.
Thank you so much for inviting. It was my pleasure.